The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up on this week's podcast, trebles all round the PCC as they release their annual report. Plus,
we were having to be fairly sort of devious, really, changing hotels every day, changing vehicles every day, doing lots of things like sort of driving down, you know, dead ends and seeing if we're being followed, that kind of thing.
We hear from the CNN reporter hunted by the military regime in Burma. Also in the show, what now for Russell T. Davis and the travelling Time Lord? We discuss the shake-up at Doctor Who and...
teeny bit of shrift. Yeah. It's what people will give you if you try to say, oh, well, I'm writing a book at the moment, I'm doing a radio show.
I actually think, yes, we've got a good record of achievement. I think there's more to come.
Danny Baker's back at Five Live, and London's LBC sign up Ken Livingstone as their newest shock jock. Will you be listening? It's all coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. This week, chat show legend Sir Michael Parkinson became the government's dignity ambassador, or something equally grand. So we can only hope that our two panellists come through the next half hour with theirs fully intact. Back by popular demand, Janine.
Really?
Janine Gibson, Media Guardian's editor-in-chief. Yes, they were clamouring for you on the blogs.
Who were?
Well, one person was.
But, but anyway. Hello, fan.
have you got a Parky impression? You probably don't do Parky, do you?
No.
Stephen Brook is MediaGuardian.co.uk's press and publishing correspondent.
I'm just merely back.
You're just back, that's right. It's a pleasure to have you all the same, Stephen. How are you?
Yeah, fine, carry on.
Not too bad. There are stories about radio and television coming up later, as well as a whole new section dedicated to your feedback. But we'll start this week with the world that used to be known as Fleet Street.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
It's been a busy week, actually, in newspaper land. Former Times editor Robert Thompson was confirmed as the new managing editor of Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal. That's the top job there, actually. And over in the House of Lords, the Mail Group's Viscount Rothermere and Trinity Mirror boss Sly Bailey created headlines of their own, talking to the Communications Committee. Meanwhile, there were smiles all round for the Press Complaints Commission after the publication of its annual report. Stephen Brook, you're our press correspondent, and you've been churning out the copy this week, haven't you?
Ah, yes.
Let's start with this... PCC report. Reasons to be cheerful. Sir Christopher Mayer always sounds very bouncy and upbeat, doesn't he? But what did the report say that was interesting, do you think?
Well, a record number of complaints, which the PCC interprets in a very positive light.
Because they always do this. They always say it's because we're much more visible and that we're with the public.
They do. But then, you know, do you take a record number of complaints as a sign that the system is working, i.e. people who are dissatisfied with what they read in the media or their treatment at the hands of Fleet Street are actually complaining to the right body? Or do you say, well, it's a sign that standards are falling and the whole system's close to collapse? I mean, the facts and figures are all there to be seen. There was an interesting issue, of course, because if you pick up the glossy The Review, as the annual report is called, and turn to the back, there's a picture of Daily Express editor Peter Hill there, who was on the board of the PCC, but as we have reported, left abruptly, very recently.
Well, with the whole Madeleine McCann thing, it was becoming untenable for his position, wasn't it, to be on the committee?
It was, but what actually emerged when Sir Christopher was giving his briefing about the annual report was it wasn't just that. Because
Oh, right.
The PCC is funded by the Newspaper Publishers Association, which in effect its members pay the bills. And there's been a big fight between Express Newspapers and the NPA because the Express doesn't want to pay its bills.
Well, they've pulled out of the
NPA. They pulled out in December, yes. And so it was felt that amongst the NPA that why should they have representation on the PCC board?
So does this mean that the Daily Express and Sunday Express are now outside of the remit of the PCC now?
No.
Right.
No, that was obviously a big issue that they had to make a ruling on, and it was decided that that would be ridiculous and would make the system of self-regulation untenable if that occurred. So, no, they're still going to be governed.
Janine, which side of the fence do you sit on? Do you think it's marvellous that there have been more complaints because that shows that the system's working, or it shows that newspapers are more intrusive?
I think it is a functioning system, but I think it has got little to do with the PCC, I'm afraid. Christopher Mayer, as you rightly point out, is always relentlessly upbeat. But I don't think it's to do with the lovely quality of advertising that the PCC puts in the papers.
On their
I think
lovely new
it
website,
is,
yes.
I think it is a culture of accountability, which has got a lot to do with digitisation of media, to do with the rise of the community, to do with the fact that everything is surfaced and people feel a right of redress and a right of reply is very much more sort of part of one's inalienable rights now. So whereas in the 80s, you can imagine reading The Sun and thinking, well, absolutely no point trying to do anything about that.
Yeah, yeah.
These days, you can go on a blog, you can start your own blog, you can, you know, expose this stuff so much more easily. That idea that it simply must be corrected is just more all-pervading in society.
No, well,
Street of Shame, yes. I would say also in Private Eye, has had a very powerful effect.
There isn't a link at the bottom there to the PCC website, is there? Let's leave the PCC there. What about this Lords Committee? Now, the Lords Committee can be really tedious sometimes, but it was not bad this week.
It was actually a pretty good episode. I toddled up to the House of Lords and happened upon Sly Bailey, who's the Trinity Mirror Chief Executive, deep in conversation with Viscount Rothermere. Bowled up, said hello. Sly, who I have met before, actually, was very chatty. And Lord Rothermere, though, as soon as he found out I was from The Guardian, the expression on his face was kind of like, you've just farted. And then he instantly dematerialized.
Did they have anything interesting to say in front of the committee?
They've gone through all the editors, pretty much, and now it's the boss's turn. And Lord Rothermere gets out into the public sphere so rarely, it was just fascinating to see what type of person he was. Mm. I don't think I've ever encountered someone so posh in my life. I think he's got a one-line strategy, though, for Daily Mail and General Trust, which is do what Paul Dacre says.
Right, very good.
Because in the evidence, time and time again, it came out that, you know, there's no editorial interference and we don't instruct Paul Dacre. Even though some bizarre question about what would you do if the Daily Mail suddenly wanted to legalize cannabis, Lord Rothermere's take on that was even that would not be of sufficient reason for them, the board, to get involved.
Also interesting stuff across the pond, Janine, this week when Robert Thompson got the job that we always knew he was ultimately going to get, the top job at the Wall Street Journal, managing editor. Not a surprise, I don't guess. But what was interesting was that the committee that Rupert Murdoch has put in to ensure editorial independence wasn't very happy about aspects of the appointment.
Yes, and the effect, I'm sure, will be very long-lasting. The most pointless committee since the Lords Committee. At least the Lords Committee, which nobody can remember what its purpose was or when it started. Or presumably
or even who the chairman is.
Or who the chairman, or what on earth goes in there. But at least they have the pulling power to get in some good guests. They've got quite a booking system. And people that we don't normally see get to turn up. Nobody even bothers to turn up to Murdoch's editorial committee, whatever they call that, the protection committee. I think Les Hinton managed a grudging, yeah, all right, sorry, out the corner of his mouth in passing.
Well, you know, the Times has a similar committee, which quiet that I actually forgot. I thought it had been disbanded.
They have lunch.
And wrote a story to the effect, which caused News International to erupt.
But could you be clear for new readers, well, new listeners, I should say, Stephen, what was the committee of the Wall Street Journal concerned about specifically when it came to Robert Thompson?
Well, its job is to safeguard the editorial independence of the Wall Street Journal as pertains to the editor and the hiring of the editor they have to approve, so it says. But of course, there seemed to be this, there was a very hasty exit of the previous managing editor, Marcus Brockley, which the committee actually couldn't really do anything about and wasn't informed about.
So it complained about that and said his departure wasn't handled very well.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Robert Thompson, he's marvellous.
Well, they did both criticise Robert Thompson for his role in the departure of his predecessor,
but then also said,
actually, we think he's marvellous.
And that his marvellousness outweighed the little bit of concern they had about his role in the departure of the previous guy.
Which Robert, to his credit, did front up to the committee and say, actually, I made a mistake.
Well done, Robert. Now, neither of you have mentioned the most interesting thing, which was the piece of reporting. Sadly, I can't remember who reported it, that Will Lewis was going to be
the
new
job.
Managing editor of the Wall Street Journal.
That
it came
was.
Out of the US. And so, you know, not even made up in London, shock. Which pointed out that Will Lewis and Robert Thompson have recently been giving an awful lot of interviews in which they regard each other as really quite some of the finest brains in publishing today.
Will Lewis, editor of the Daily Telegraph, of course. Now, you interviewed Condé Nast, uber nasty Nicholas Coleridge, didn't you?
Uber nice.
The second
poshest person I've ever met, I think.
How was he?
Class wars are alive and well in the New Guardian podcast.
Well, no, he does posh very well and was thoroughly entertaining.
What did he talk to you about?
Charming. Well, you know, magazines are in an interesting position, aren't they? Because over the past 5 years, they've launched madly and total circulation is actually larger than it was 5 years ago, measured against the decline of print newspapers. But then they haven't really got digital strategy down pat at all. And he was actually saying that 7% of Condé Nast revenues come from digital. That's it.
Well, the big thing, of course, with magazines is front covers. And we've got a clip of your interview, actually, with him when he was talking about celebrity front covers.
Great challenge around here is keeping the cover stars going. Because we have six magazines that use celebrities, Vogue, Tatler, GQ, Vanity Fair, Glamour, and Easy Living, they're quite often, to some extent, competing with one another to get particular celebrities to be on the covers. The negotiations to get particular celebrities take months. I mean, some of them take as much as a year,
right,
to get them. And I think we're quite unusual, and the thing that probably sets the Condé Nast magazines apart from many of the competitors is that we take the photographs that we have on the cover are taken by us, specially for us. They're not picked up from agencies, they're not pap shots, they're new. And we had a particularly good, I was very proud of the April issues, because we had they had a fantastic Vogue cover of Victoria Beckham, which was about 10% up on the previous year. And Tatler had Princess Eugenie, which was
got a lot of attention.
35% up. And then Colin Farrell was on GQ that month, and that had taken Dylan, I think, about 8 months to get him. And then Keira Knightley was on Easy Living, and Lily Allen was on Glamour. So there was it was particularly good.
Nicholas Coleridge, the whole gamut beautifulness of that interview in Media Guardian on Monday.
Monday week, I think.
Monday week, all right. Enough of that. You can read more about all of these stories that we've just mentioned on our website, mediaguardian.co.uk. I'm Matt Wells, you're listening to Media Talk. Still to come, we'll be going all points of view as we address the burning issues you've been writing in about. Auntie Janine is primed and ready to advise. Plus...
I'm excited.
Well, it's very exciting. Plus...
Welcome to the new sound of LBC 97.3, beginning a new era for London's biggest conversation.
I want to start by thanking those Londoners who supported me today and have supported me in the past. Over many years.
But will they be listening to you in the future? Former Mayor Ken Livingston signs up to present a lunchtime show on London talk station LBC. All that and much more still ahead, but first to something a bit more serious. As the humanitarian crisis in Burma continues to grow more urgent after Cyclone Nargis, the military regime is still enforcing its rigid restrictions over foreign journalists. CNN's Bangkok correspondent Dan Rivers has just returned from reporting in the country, where he found himself in a game of cat and mouse with a ruling junta. I spoke to him earlier to find out a bit more about his time in the jungle.
Well, we knew almost as soon as we arrived that it was going to be problematic. The authorities didn't want any reporters in there. That was fairly clear. They hadn't issued any journalistic visas. We became aware after about 12 hours through one of our local fixers that the authorities were already looking for Western reporters. We've been told that they'd asked all of the hotels to report any foreigners staying in Rangoon. So that put us on alert, and then things sort of spiralled steadily downhill after the first day.
What sort of precautions did you take against being found?
Well, we were having to be fairly sort of devious, really, changing hotels every day, changing vehicles every day, doing lots of things like sort of driving down, you know, dead ends and seeing if we were being followed, that kind of thing. In the end, you know, it was becoming increasingly frustrating. We gradually realized that they were actually specifically looking for me. As soon as we took the decision to put me on air and to name me after about 24 hours, really because we just decided that the story was of such a massive scale that it was important that, you know, that we had as much impact as we could in our reporting, we decided that the best way of doing that was for me to be able to look down the screen and do live shots for the TV and to do pieces to camera. Now, of course, that's a tough judgment to make, but we decided to do that. And, of course, as soon as we did that, then I was very much a marked man, and they were then specifically looking for me.
And things got rather hairy at one point, didn't they, when you stopped at a checkpoint?
first of all, the rest of my crew were picked up and they were questioned. I was sort of hiding in a cafe around the corner at this point. They were all questioned and the authorities actually had a photo of me that they'd taken off air from CNN, and they were comparing everyone's passport photos to my photo. Then we moved on from them further into the Irrawaddy Delta. We actually hit a checkpoint. I was sort of hidden in the back of our car under a blanket, and they were again looking for me specifically. We were turned around and told we had to go back to a previous checkpoint. And it was at that point basically that we kind of thought, you know, we're fairly cornered here. We were fairly sure they didn't realize that the crew were with CNN, but they obviously were suspicious we were Westerners. They hadn't spotted me. So we actually had to sort of then drive off down a sort of jungle track, really into the middle of nowhere, and ended up sort of getting in some boats and paddling down the river in a bid to sort of escape these two checkpoints.
Were you surprised at the length that the authorities were prepared to go to find you, when you would have thought that they might be better engaged, you know, doing other things to help the poor people who you were reporting on?
Well, I mean, this is just the extraordinary thing was the amount of time and energy that had clearly gone into stopping. I mean, it wasn't only me. The BBC reporter, one of my colleagues, Andrew Harding from the BBC, was deported on arrival. I know, having talked to other journalists at Reuters, with Channel 4 News, I mean, all of them were going through sort of fairly similar situations with checkpoints, with police checking for journalists. And the whole time, you know, you're seeing around you the most dreadful scenes of devastation, of death, of bodies being recovered, of people having nothing, no food, no water, no aid. And yet the authorities are spending all this time and energy just keeping reporters out. And, you know, this isn't a man-made catastrophe, or wasn't at the beginning anyway, a man-made catastrophe. This is a natural disaster. And really all we were trying to do was to go there to show people this is how bad it is and this is what they need. And frankly, I was just flabbergasted with the amount of energy that went into stopping that simple story getting out.
And of course, the consequence, I guess, is that the media attention just moves on, because, you know, despite however much enthusiasm and however much energy and commitment any news organisation has to getting a story, ultimately, you know, if you're frustrated, attention is going to move on to a different story, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and especially in TV as well. I mean, you know, where TV is so governed by getting pictures out, and it became so difficult to get pictures out from there. You know, A, the communications are terrible, the phone lines are down, the mobile phone network's down, and it's just very risky for us to try and get those pictures out, you know, whether it's through getting tapes out through third parties or through using equipment in the country. And you're right, you know, sooner or later, if you're not getting the pictures out to keep that story alive, the news agenda moves on and people lose interest. So it's incredibly frustrating for us on the ground. We're seeing all these terrible things, and yet it's so difficult to get the story out to the rest of the world.
Looking back on it now, you're right there, you went through some rather surreal experience. Do you enjoy all that James Bond sort of stuff?
To be honest, it was all pretty nerve-wracking, and, you know, while it certainly makes, you know, for a good chapter in the memoirs one day, at the time, it is pretty stomach-churning. I mean, my main concern is, you know, was not really so much for my own safety, because I think the worst that they were going to probably do is just kick me out. But it's really for the local staff that we're working with there who, I mean, these guys are incredibly brave. I mean, they are basically, you know, putting their lives, their families' lives on the line to help us and get the story out. And if one of those guys gets caught, you know, they're looking at years in prison and you know, even worse, torture and so on. That was at the forefront of my mind, was, you know, not so much what's going to happen to me personally, but, you know, what's going to happen to the guys that are helping us here and to the incredibly brave journalists that we're using to help us on the ground.
CNN International's Dan Rivers now taking a much-deserved holiday in Sydney. Now, we've linked to the piece that he wrote for Organ Grinder on our own blog this week. Do make sure you have a read. To follow our coverage of the latest from Burma, head to guardian.co.uk/world. Let's turn to radio. This week, London talk station LBC caused many of us to choke on our cornflakes after it announced that Ken Livingstone would be exchanging his soapbox for a microphone, presenting the station's lunchtime programme. Now, those of you who live within the M25 may remember a much-missed media show presented by yours truly on LBC a few years ago, back in the days when they had some proper programmes, long before they were bought up by Global.
I used to listen to your show. Yes. Even I don't remember it.
It was not nearly as good as this podcast. I have to say, because it was this podcast being much better produced, obviously. Talking about Media Talks producer Ben Green, he also used to work at LBC, actually. So we both had very good reason to speak to our radio correspondent, John Plunkett, to find out exactly what's going on at our alma mater. Producer Ben won that battle, and he began by asking John about the return of Danny Baker to the 606 phone-in on 5 Live.
That's right. He's back to Radio 5 Live. He's been there before. Unfortunately, in the past, he's had a habit of not staying there very long. And as he said himself, he's the only man who's been fired from the BBC 3 times. And not even Kenny Everett managed that. So it's good to have him back, yes.
Why does he want to go back?
I think it's quite a big opportunity for him. It's a bigger audience than he has where he is currently. And he did a podcast, as you'll remember, which unfortunately came to a sticky end because of financing problems. So I think a lot of people would be glad to have him back. 606 on Radio 5 has lots and lots of different presenters. But I don't think anyone quite matches Baker in terms of wit, and I think he's a good signing.
Now, he's also famously sacked from 606 on one occasion because he did a whole show with Danny Kelly and didn't take any callers. And the format of 606 now is so much drier than his own brand of humour. Is he going to have to bend slightly here?
Well, I hope not. You suspect maybe they try and do that, but given his track record, if they do try and do that, maybe he'll resist it and he'll be out the door again. But I hesitate to predict a fourth untimely departure for Danny.
But the biggest radio story of the week has to be my old stomping ground, LBC. They've just
London's biggest conversation.
They've just made a ridiculous signing.
Well, you say ridiculous. Who can it be? It's someone that is popular with Londoners, who will surely get their vote if there was, say, a poll between him and a few other people. No, he didn't win, did he? No, it's the defeated London mayoral candidate after 8 years in office, Mr. Ken Livingstone.
Noted for his
broadcasting voice.
Absolutely.
I can speak.
LBC have made a couple of these appointments in the past. Tony Blair was the first sitting prime minister, or into any sort of prime minister, I imagine.
Right, yeah, I was imagining. I think Edward Heath did it a while. No, he didn't, though.
To do a phone-in show. Why have they done this?
I think it's he didn't win the election, clearly, if my memory serves me right. But I think he is still quite a popular figure, and he's got a lot of history. People know him, and I think it's kind of almost stunt scheduling in the sense that it will get the station talked about. Whether he's got the kind of voice you want to tune in for 3 hours on a weekly basis, I'm not so sure.
And this is only as a cover presenter, Ralph?
Initially as a cover presenter when he fills in on the weekday afternoon slot, but then in a slot to be announced, he's actually going to come back on a weekly basis, yeah. I do hear there might be a bit of a format to the show, so it won't be a straight-off phone-in, so how that'll work out, I don't know. But it'll be intriguing to hear his first broadcast, and probably more intriguing for the producer behind the glass that looks after him on that first show.
Media Talk from Guardian.co.uk.
John Plunkett there. Stephen Brook, will you be tuning in?
I'm a bit curious about this one. I'm all for a bit of a left-wing phone-in host because, let's face it, LBC is very right-wing most of the time. But that station is founded on people ringing up, having a whinge about London. What's Ken going to say to them?
Sorry about that.
Sorry about the bendy buses. Sorry about the garbage. That's all my fault.
It'll have to be balanced, which is presumably why they're going to format it. If you look at James Whale, who just got fired from Talk Radio for urging everybody to vote for Boris.
Well, the thing that happened there was that happened during an election campaign when the Representation of the People's Act kicks in. You don't have to be balanced all the time, I think is the case. Anyway.
Well, he can't exactly interview Boris, though, can he?
No, but I think we're getting off topic now. Anyway, if you want to listen to Red Ken on London's Biggest Conversation, he starts at the end of June. It's bound to be fab. Now, time for some of your feedback. Ian Walk's written to say,
been following the licence fee debate with interest, and I'm concerned that the BBC currently provides the best online news service, arguably, the best radio, without a doubt, the best TV, though the competition is pants. Do we really want more choice, or should we not just be safeguarding this provider of excellent services?
This is top slicing, Janine, which is... So don't sit there and yawn.
No, I wasn't yawning. I was just open-mouthed in admiration at our viewer, listener, user's perspicacity, because yes. I couldn't agree more, especially as I've decided that the iPlayer is the only way to watch television.
It is fantastic.
So I have confined myself solely to the BBC's output within the last 7 days on an A to Z basis, and I couldn't agree more. This is the way forward. We're not only are we not top slicing the licence fee. I'm sorry, Andy Duncan. You've failed to persuade me now. But also, we're just shutting down ITV and taking all of okay. that revenue as well.
All right. Thank you very much. Ben Bailey asks,
regarding the ITV fines scandal, how does TV in general come back from this? Since the problems were uncovered, we have seen the swift removal of phone-ins from our screens. Whilst I'm not going to mourn the loss of phone-in competitions, I will be saddened if it turns out that consumers of media feel uncomfortable to voice their comments and opinions on news and current affairs because they're concerned about being ripped off. One of the most exciting additions to reporting over the last few years has been the involvement of the man on the street. It would be a crying shame if that side of input was lost because of this sad, sad affair.
Auntie Janine, over to you again.
Do you know, I was with you all the way, perspicacious user, viewer, listener, until the bit where you said that the best innovation in reporting for the last few years has been the involvement of the man on the street.
The cheapest innovation.
Cheapest, most prevalent, largely witless. However, up until that point,
and what's new about
you
that?
Couldn't be more right. And also I refer you to the previous caller, because quite clearly the answer is we will have no more phone-in fraud if we divert all TV resources to the BBC.
I think we might have been sounded a bit elitist there. I was classist earlier on. You're being elitist now about the phone-ins and stuff, aren't you?
Why am I being elitist about Vox Pops?
Because we're smug and you called the great British unwashed witless.
No,
just a few
No. I did not say they were witless. Vox Pops are witless.
Oh, right, okay.
Going up to somebody in the street and going, what do you think about the situation in Burma? Generally, and I don't think this is elitism, this is, I would be the same were I on that pavement. I'm not judging. Generally doesn't provoke an extremely thought-through response.
Okay, well,
I had to Vox Pop people once early in my journalistic
yeah.
career.
What did you get?
Well, I wore a suit and I was standing outside a church and everyone ran away from me because they thought I was trying to convert them.
Yeah,
very good. Yeah. Well, I think that feature was a resounding success, don't you?
I love that feature.
I think we'll do it again.
I'll do it as a pre-record.
Okay. Now, Gareth McLean isn't here this week, sadly, but we have two TV fans in the studio here, in the form.
Is it on the iPlayer?
I was going to talk about Doctor Who, and that is definitely on the iPlayer. The first thing I want to talk about in this section is Russell T. Davis, who is... Well, he's not retiring, is he? Because he's not that old. But he's leaving his position as showrunner on Doctor Who. Now, we talked to Russell T. Davis back in December, and this is what he said to Media Talk.
Eventually, I will be free to write something with sex and swearing and gay men, but not yet, not for at least another year or so.
So you're staying with Doctor Who for at least one more year?
Oh, I love it, yeah, honestly. Wait till you see this Christmas episode. It's like, it's a ball, and nowhere else will you ever get the chance to write stuff like this. I'm very aware that when I leave this little BBC Wales empire, that I'll be going back joyously to writing about people in kitchens having domestics, but actually while I'm here and while I've got the chance to write these extraordinary big pictures and with the support and the budget and everything, then you might as well enjoy it. You know, everyone's always too fast to move on. It's like, make the most of it while you can.
Russell T. Davis, though, this is very interesting, isn't it? A very interesting and relevant clip, Stephen Brook, because you wrote about the gayness of Doctor Who this week, didn't you?
I did, actually, as part of a blog on the Organ Grinder Post.
And what was the reaction?
Well, controversy reigned, actually. I got attacked from all quarters, I think. Basically, I said that under Russell T. Davis, the program had got very sexual. And as part of that, I said it was too childish, too camp and too gay, which upset a lot of people.
Organ grinding indeed.
Yes, yeah. So...
people weren't very happy. But anyway, so he's leaving now. Do you think that will make a difference to the show, Janine? They've appointed Stephen Moffat.
I do. Now, I'm not in the it's got to be one or the other camp. I think amongst your Doctor Who hardcore, it can go a little bit rabid. It can go, but you've either got to be the RTD fan or the Stephen Moffat fan.
Yeah.
I think we all need to take a step back and pay a moment's tribute to the great Russell T. Davis for bringing back Doctor Who in such a brilliant way, completely transforming family viewing. take in the rest of the coverage for the last 3 years. But Stephen Moffat has undoubtedly written all the best and most interesting episodes.
Recently, at least. Yes.
No, from the beginning.
Oh, from the beginning.
From the beginning. Yeah. No, the Empty Child, the Fireplace one.
Girl with the Fireplace.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
They were all brilliant. And he's a fantastic writer. And presumably, he will not attempt to write every episode himself. Will continue to run it as a stable.
That would be the mistake.
Because he will need to bring in some people with a bit of lightness, or else it'll go sort of relentlessly dark and sinister.
And the ratings will drop off the edge of a cliff.
They won't drop, but it will skew a bit older.
It'll certainly will. From RTD to RDF, more fallout from Crowngate. RDF, the production company, reported 67% fall in profits at £2 million in the first set of full-year financial results since the affair. And we're not remotely sympathetic, are we, Janine?
No tears being shed.
No tears being shed on the pod. The Apprentice, Stephen, did you watch that this week?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
He's gone, finally.
Well...
Oh, God, no, I am elitist. I love Rafe.
You love it? You don't.
I do. I'm not alone either.
This is your public school background here. This is
very, very minor private school, if you check the list in Private Eye.
I wasn't going to bring Private Eye up, but now that we've got onto elitism, there was a...
Would you have made that list, Matt?
I would most certainly not have made that list.
Chip.
No, at least Gareth McLean's not here. The chip on his shoulder is about twice the size of mine.
Yeah, well, he couldn't fit through the door.
No, that's why he's not here. That's why he's not here.
I think it was...
I should explain, before we go on, that in Private Eye this week, there was a list of, in the Street of Shame column that you mentioned, there was a list of all the Guardian executives who've been to public or private, whatever you call it, fee-paying schools, I think is what they're called. And Janine, it has to be said, you were the last on the list.
It's because my private school is the least impressive private school in the history of private schools.
I simply think
if I'm going to be hung for it in Private Eye, I could at least have gone somewhere a bit better.
I have to say I hadn't heard of it. It wasn't Benenden, was it? No.
It just started with a W. I thought that was why it was last.
Oh, right. Oh, alphabetic.
Yeah. But with The Apprentice, yes. I think that Rafe would be the third poshest person I've encountered.
The third poshest. Yeah. Okay.
You're Australian. How would you know?
What was brilliant about the episode, I thought, was and this is a tribute to the actual skills of the production people. I couldn't really tell which team had won or lost until right in the boardroom, where Sir Alan brilliantly erupted in a brilliant fashion. He just couldn't hold it in and said, "You've bloody lost. You don't realise."
It was brilliant.
And that program gets better and better. I think there's always a fear, and Big Brother's got to change the format every year because people are going to get bored. Not with The Apprentice.
Well, it turns out he's signed up for another two series, isn't it?
I was just thinking about this earlier, and I think the reason The Apprentice just is head and shoulders above all the rest of the reality formats, it's just got to be the time and the attention. It's really old-fashioned basic qualities. Like, they must spend a year making it. Mm. They have teams of people. There's real depth to it. When it's edited, they really are telling stories. They're not forcing things in. Rafe, he did go on a journey. When he said on The Apprentice, "You're fired," over on BBC Two afterwards, and he said, I hoped that people would think, you know, the pillock did good, and he sort of got better, and he thought, he did do that. And actually, I'd like to say, that the non-elitist You're Fired audience all voted that he should have stayed.
Really? Mm. Very good. Yeah, I never watched that. I think I just like to... I'm a bit of a purist.
If you watched you'd been more in touch with what the people think.
I don't watch it because it clashes with News at 10. But I do agree with you
about... We are the only three people in this building that weren't watching the football last night, you do.
I watched the football and then I Sky Plus The Apprentice, you see.
I did love Sir Alan's entrance, which gets back to your point about time and attention to detail, when Nick and Margaret were in the foreground of the shot and this shadow appeared on the wall of the National Theatre.
Yeah.
That then morphed into Sir Alan.
And the cutaways, you know, the way they use the cutaways of Nick and Margaret
Margaret cutaways this year.
We should do a montage of Margaret cutaways for the site.
The best line of the whole series, Margaret, Edinburgh's not what it used to be.
I know, it's brilliant. Anyway, I agree, I used to live there, she's right. That's your lot for this week. Head to the block.
I'm the elitist.
I wasn't talking about the university, I meant the city, just. Head to the...
That's even worse.
Yeah. are people eating in the streets, Matt?
Yes, it's all the Spanish tourists.
The rabble who go for the festival. It's ridiculous.
I know, it goes through the whole year now. It used to be, it was just, don't get me started, it used to be April to September, and now the council instituted this year-round tourist destination thing, and there's people the whole time. You can't escape them. And you can't buy soy milk anywhere. That's your lot for this week.
Soya milk.
That's your lot for this week. Head to the blog for links to all the stories that we've just discussed.
Edinburgh does not want you back.
Well, you can in Valvona and Crawler, anyway. And if you want to give us your feedback, post a comment on Organ Grinder or our Facebook wall. My thanks to Janine Gibson and Stephen Brook. Media Talk is produced by the marvellous Ben Green, who's whispered all the best jokes for today in my ear. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.